not feel the pain again. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me and for coming to the talk. I understand I have about 40 to 50 minutes, even an hour, but I will try to keep it to less than an hour so we have more time for Q&A. Okay. So, at the start of this presentation, I want to acknowledge that the research was done with a postdoc at my university in the Asian Research Institute. Her name is Jenny Chu, and she's currently working at Hong Kong University. So today's presentation is on elderly care circulations, but this project actually builds on my earlier work, which the book is being passed around now, and it's on citizens in motion. So while my earlier work looked more at younger migrants, in one of the projects I did on mainland Chinese immigration and re-migration, I became quite interested in how older migrants navigate social reproduction concerns across borders. So building on this book, we then started, my colleagues and I, we started on a new project to do with how do migrants negotiate their social reproduction concerns across the life course. So just as with this book, the project, in particular, this component on grandparenting migration, we were interested not only in how grandparents engage with care, both in terms of giving care as well as receiving care now, but also their intentions and how they envision aging to be later in the life course. So this is the project that we are presenting to you today. The fieldwork was newly finished in December, so we're still quite fresh out of the research findings. And I just want to contextualize this particular component in the wider project. The wider project is on transnational relations and care ethics. For short, we call it TRACE. And it's interested in how Singapore functions as a hub of global migration, both inflows as well as outflows. And in the project, we looked at three field sites in particular. So Singapore and its care connections to Myanmar through foreign domestic worker migration, and also Singapore's care connections to China. Singapore's care connections to China are bi-directional. And in this particular presentation, we're looking at PRC grandparenting migrants in Singapore. But another component is studying how older Singaporeans negotiate aging in Singapore and in China. So I will leave that for another presentation because the fieldwork is still ongoing. Our fourth research site is in Australia, Sydney, and that is a comparative study with the PRC grandparents in Singapore. So today's presentation will look at Singapore and Australia as immigration sites for the PRC grandparenting migrants. Okay, so what's the context of our interest in PRC grandparenting migrant migration? As all of you know, China had practiced a one-child policy between 1979 to 2013. And Vanessa Wong has written about the one-child policy and its connections with migration. So her argument is with the single-child policy in China, parents invested a lot of emotional and financial resources in their children, the only child, which includes sending them to study overseas when they were younger. So wealthier Chinese families send their children abroad in pursuit of a Western-style education. Other young adults whose parents are now in our study, the grandparenting migration we're looking at, these other young adults sought overseas careers independently. So they may have been educated in China first, but subsequently perhaps did a postgraduate degree overseas or went on to look for work in Singapore and Australia. Now, we wanted to capture this transition in their life course of the family. So as the adult children transition into working life, they also start young families abroad. And in the context of the immigration policies of these countries, in particular Singapore and Australia, they both practice a managed migration approach, which means they're highly selective about the types of young immigrants they take in, depending on skills, educational level, income level, and also age. So Singapore in particular is using replacement migration to address concerns over declining fertility rates and the demand for a younger labor force to work in Singapore's economy. Now, what we found was many of these PRC adult children, so PRC, People's Republic of China, just for short, I'll use the acronym PRC. The adult children struggle to balance their work and childcare duties while they are living in Singapore and Australia. And so they call on their parents to cross borders to carry out grandparenting duties. That's why we decided to focus our study on grandparenting migration. Because much of migration research has focused on younger migrants, in particular people who are called on to sort of participate in a country's labor force later. But we came to realize that the grandparenting migrants were an important aspect of the migration flow, and although they are no longer productive in the workforce, but they were carrying out important social reproduction roles. Again, as I mentioned, the immigration countries that we studied practice a managed migration approach. So they have fairly strict requirements in terms of the types of migrants they would give longer term permanent residency or citizenship rights to. And these grandparenting migrants, because they are older, they tend to come perhaps on, or they attempt to join their children on the family reunification schemes. But in both Australia and Singapore, it is very difficult to actually qualify for permanent residency, much less citizenship this way. So maybe just briefly to give you some context, I think the majority of the PRC grandparents we spoke to were either on tourist visas, which are very short term, or otherwise they were on temporary social visit passes between 1 year to 1 year to 3 years, in rare cases 5 years. And in our study in Singapore, possibly only one out of the 30 interviewees we spoke to had permanent residency. It was slightly better in the Sydney case, but still a minority. So as I mentioned, in the study, we were interested not only to understand better the grandparents' experiences of doing childcare and aging abroad, but also where do they envision themselves in the future? So where will they spend their older years later on in the life course? And extrapolating from that, what we're trying to also analyze better is what are the implications for care ethics in the transnational world? And the context of this is national debates on elder care in particular tend to be contained within the national society. So if you're a citizen, you are more likely to have certain maybe social rights, okay, as an older person. But if you're a migrant and you don't have the right to remain, you are also not unable, you are also unable to tap into social rights in the immigration country. And when you cannot remain in that immigration country in your later years, you end up going back, in this case, to China, who then becomes responsible for your care. So in carrying out this research project, I think the wider question we wanted to grapple with was what are the implications for care ethics? And of course, we want to approach this in a grounded way through the narratives that the older people were sharing with us. So it's not merely a normative take on care ethics, but one that's grounded in empirical fieldwork. So briefly, for this particular presentation, I want to engage with three ideas. One on social reproduction and its relation to migration. The second is on a set of literature to do with care circulations, okay, capturing the circulation of people, emotions, materiality. And the third pillar is on care ethics. But I will combine care circulations and care ethics together as I go through the subsequent slides. So on social reproduction and migration, I think when we talk about social reproduction, maybe the question that comes to mind is, how is labor power central to production that is constituted outside of the workplace considered? How do we pay attention to what takes place outside of the workplace, but the kind of everyday, you know, routines, needs that are serviced, which are central to making productive workers? So feminists, in particular feminist geographers, have critiqued capitalist production for its binary categorization of production and production and social reproduction. And feminist geographers have focused in particular on how these roles to do with production and reproduction tend to be met onto, say, the public sphere, the workplace, in terms of productive activities, And then when it comes to reproductive work, it tends to be transplanted onto home. So feminist geographers have questioned the public-private divide to do with these kinds of uses of space. In addition to that, they've also argued that we should critically investigate how certain ideologies to do with care work, to do with parenting or grandparenting duties, might become reproduced as common sense. So people taking for granted that this is their role in life, during a particular life stage, and how these ideologies then contribute to social reproduction activities. And the last point I want to make here is geographer Catherine Mitchell has talked about, in the context of globalization, these activities and critiques of capitalist reproduction are no longer just contained within the national state, but through the global circuits of capital and of people, the state, on the one hand, while it's challenged, on the other hand, it has also become even more important in regulating these global circuits. As I mentioned, therefore, the role of the Singaporean and the Australian governments in regulating immigration flows through managed migration. Okay, so just an overview in terms of the different sets of literature to do with social reproduction and migration. There's been a set of scholarship on the relationship between gender, work, and migration. In particular, one branch of it looks at how foreign domestic workers in countries like Hong Kong, Singapore, contribute towards supporting the reproductive needs of families in these immigration countries. Related to that, there have also been research carried out on left-behind children and grandparenting roles in sending countries. There are parallels between international migration and internal migration patterns when it comes to these debates on social reproduction and migration. Another set of literature has focused on education-led migration and how mothers in particular have taken on important roles to support families that are separated across borders. So for instance, astronaut families, geese families, and parachute children are trends that have been studied in the context of Canada, Australia, and the US. Okay, and this is study mothers. This one's quite particular to the case of Singapore. And these are how PRC mothers join their children, young children who study in Singapore, and then the Singapore government's immigration regulation is such that the mother can come along, but the father can't join the child and the mother in Singapore. So one thing that we found out from doing our current research on grandparenting migration is, while the literature on study mothers has focused on the role of mothers, through our research we realized that there are a few grandmothers who came to take on these caring roles for their grandchildren instead. So I just wanted to put this out there to link this set of literature to the field we have been doing. So overall, the literature on social reproduction and migration have highlighted the role of intimate labor. Okay, so how intimate labor services the needs of productive labor in workplaces. It's also precarious work, precarious familyhood for families who live apart. There are generational transfers implicated in terms of how resources are channeled from parents and grandparents to young children. So these together, they contribute to the reproduction of life. Moving on then to my other conceptual theme on care themes on care circulations and care ethics. So in our research on grandparenting migration, one of the conceptual themes that we use has to do with the idea of care circulations, which is popularized by Baldessa and Merler in an edited volume that they did. And there they highlighted that the earlier research on global care chains, it tends to focus on south-north migration. Okay, and these types of migration are done in exchange for financial security. So for instance, domestic worker migration, right? But they propose that the framework of care circulations actually extends the parameters of study to how migrants and their relatives are not only providers of care, they are also receivers of care. So care circulations look at reciprocal flows of exchange of resources, and of course these flows of resources may not be, they may be asymmetrical during certain contexts, during the stages of migration. Overall, they suggested that this framework of care circulations can help to extend the focus on south-north migration and on the transactional aspects of migration to the other types of emotional, material, and non-material exchanges of resources that happens during care migration. And I think what was also really helpful for us was they highlighted that the interest in foreign domestic worker migration tends to be limited to studying low-skilled work. And their focus on care circulations wanted to draw attention to how decisions around care are made in middle-class families. And indeed, the grandparenting migrants and the families that we studied tend to be middle-class families who have the resources to migrate in the very first place. So in trying to bring the link between care circulations and PRC grandparenting migration, in the course of doing our study, we started to notice that there are transformations occurring in the private sphere of familyhood in the context of PRC migrant families. And what's happening in the private sphere, the domestic sphere, is very much shaped by changes that were also taking place in China in the public sphere to do with a greater provision of social rights and protection for older persons in aging China. So whereas in the past, one might think of China as a... I'll put it differently. I would say that in recent years, the Chinese government has started to pay more attention to the needs of an aging population, including making sure that there are sort of more universal protection schemes available for elder care needs. So the private sphere of what's happening in migrant families is then tied to changes in the public sphere in the sending country, but also on immigration society's decisions over who has the right or does not have the right to engage in family reunification. Okay, so those three were our conceptual pillars, and now I want to talk more about the fieldwork that we did, how we did it, and what we found. So one may ask, you know, why did we choose to focus on Sydney and Singapore? Okay, so one obvious reason is because these two countries are attractive destinations for Chinese migrant families which are interested in pursuing a Western education or having a what they presume to be a better quality of life. The other reason is, I've already mentioned, that both countries adopt a managed migration approach, which means that they actually rank migrants by their so-called desirability based on the skills, education levels, income levels that they have, as well as their age group. So if you're younger, in the case of Singapore, you are more likely to get permanent residency because the state sees you as a potential family unit that can add to fertility rates in Singapore, to put it very bluntly. So what it means is that for older migrants, it therefore suggests that the family reunification schemes in Singapore and Australia have also become more restrictive over the years. So we used to think that Australia is a country that had a fairly liberal, democratic kind of approach. But over the years, Australia has actually tightened its immigrant visa categories for older people who try to come in on the family reunification scheme. So in our study, we found that in both Singapore and Australia, a number of the grandparents would come in on short-term tourist visas, usually between 3 to 6 months, okay, and they engage in a sort of transnational shuttle, sometimes involving also in-laws, or one spouse comes at a particular time during the year and the other spouse comes for the other 6 months. So tourist visas are one way by which they spend time in Sydney and Singapore. Some of them had long-term social visit passes, but this is also tied to the children's visa status. In particular, in the Singapore case, just to give you some context, when the way that visa decisions are made in Singapore, it's actually not very clear to the general public or to applicants how it's decided whether they qualify or they don't qualify. It's just information that the state doesn't release. Okay, but I think just anecdotally, we did realize that the grandparents' ability to get a long-term social visit pass is very much tied to the children's own visa status, what kind of work they do in Singapore, what is their income and skill level. What was also interesting in the Australia case is Australia does have an aged parent scheme, but our respondents told us that in order to successfully apply for this scheme, you might end up waiting for 10 to 20 years. So for instance, if you apply in your 60s, you might end up getting permission to move to Australia only when you are in the 70s or 80s. So it's a very long wait. There is a fast track contributory visa scheme. So if a family is willing to pay, I think, 40,000 Australian dollars, they can actually get a fast track visa. Okay, but 40,000 Australian dollars is a hefty amount of money, which even if the family has that sum, they may not be willing to use it to apply for a permanent residency scheme for the aged parent. There's a third option, and these are for families that urgently or feel that it's important for their families, for their parents, okay, the grandparent, to come to Australia here and now. And so if you apply for this scheme, you're also meant to, I think, sign an undertaking to say that you do not intend to apply for permanent residency to Australia in the future. So it's kind of, you know, you get permission now, but that's in exchange of your future ability to remain. So these are the reasons why, from a more conceptual level, Australia and Singapore were interesting and we felt productive cases to study in terms of how is care migration being managed in very commodified ways or increasingly restrictive terms and conditions. So, in terms of our methodology, okay, so we conducted around 30 interviews in Singapore and 30 interviews in Sydney. The total number of interviews is 60. In reality, we did more than that, but we're in the process of sieving out which are the more useful interviews for us to retain in our coding sample. So in Singapore, we chose to focus our research in a mature housing estate in the west of Singapore. It's called Jurong. And the reason we chose it is it's a mature housing estate where there are lots of older Singaporeans, and that was convenient for another part of our study. But also, Jurong is changing with new immigration. So the PRC grandparenting sort of presence is actually very visible in the Jurong area. In Sydney, we carried out our research in a few different neighborhoods because the PRC grandparents were more dispersed. Also, we had a shorter period of time, and for practicality's sake, we decided to recruit in a more extended way. So we did our interviews in Asheville, Hurstville, and their surrounding neighborhoods. I should also add, and this may be interesting for the students having the roundtable later, that in addition to the 30 interviews we did, we selected a sample from each country of about 10 grandparents who were willing, basically, for us to bug them for a bit more. So we asked them to participate in additional go-alongs so that our researchers can understand better their everyday care routines, how they carry out grandparenting duties, and what are the activities they engage in for self-care. Then alongside that, we wanted to use this project to engage with research on qualitative GIS, quality GIS. So we also had these 10 grandparents in each country carry GPS trackers, which actually were quite large. But basically, I think they were very kind to continue to participate. And the GPS tracks enabled us to obtain points of the actual routes that they take over a 7-day period. So if you look at the map here, this is a map generated from the GPS tracks that shows us where the grandparent went to during certain times of the day. This is for a 7-day period, but because of the challenges of doing this method, I would say that it was not always possible to get 7 days full tracking. So this is something we have to sort of consider carefully when we're doing our data analysis, and we are still in the process of doing that. We did get ethics clearance for this, in case any of you feel that this is very intrusive, and we have anonymized, you know, the personal information as well. So you may ask, why did we choose to collect the GPS data? We wanted to use it for follow-on qualitative interviews. So by generating the maps, we then got the we sat down the grandparents on a separate day and did follow-up interviews, asking them to explain to us, why did you go to this place, what do you do, how often do you go there, etc. And we also did an additional visual methodology, visual method to do with. So if you look at this, sorry, it's very small here, but this is basically an activity we get them to engage in by selecting pictures that will help to illustrate the way that they see their aging experience now as compared to how they envision or hope their aging experience would be. So for example, with this particular case, the grandparent put the mobile phone at the center of the map of the activity, because the mobile phone was an important communication device for him in keeping in touch with the family members he had left behind in China while he's in Singapore. Okay, so this is part of our methodology. Just for some context, our respondents were aged between 51 to 72, so mainly the young old, but with, I think, good activity, fitness status, because they have left their home countries to do grandparenting duties. They come from a diverse range of regions in China, so there wasn't like a concentration of a particular part of China. And they were mostly from middle class and urban backgrounds, although we did have a couple, I think in the interview sample, who I think was from a rural part of China, and the son had previously went to study in Singapore on a scholarship. Okay, so now moving on to some of our key findings. So in this slide, I wanted to highlight, you know, how the grandparents think about the work, okay, that they engage in in Singapore and Sydney, as grandparents who have left their home countries to care for grandchildren abroad. The grandparents compared it, one of them used the metaphor of a second work life. So they felt that they had retired in China, but then was going now to a foreign country in order to support the needs of their adult children abroad. And for example, in this case, this couple from Sydney said that, I think this was the husband, and he said actually when he was due to retire in China, his company had wanted to re-employ him. So he could have stayed on in productive work, but he couldn't commit because the adult child, his son or daughter, needed extra support for childcare duties. And the grandchild, the grandson was very young. His mother needed to work, and the grandparents felt that, you know, the daughter couldn't simply be a homemaker. Okay, and she needed to continue working in order to avoid falling behind. So in this particular interview narrative, you can see very clearly the grandparents are there to service the needs of adult children who want to be or are expected to be active in the labor workforce. So these are the types of social relations between the grandparent with the adult child, okay, or the parent, and the grandparent with the grandchild, as well as the adult child with their own children. So there's a very multi-generational aspect to this research that we haven't really had the time to fully flesh out systematically, but the intergenerational relations are definitely an integral part of the decision-making of the grandparenting migrants. So these are the types of social relations that contribute to the daily and long-term reproduction of labor power for production. So what are these types of daily activities that the grandparents take on? Next slide, okay? Not this one. But here, I just want to highlight first that in our interviews, the grandparents often talked about the belief in sacrifice, that they felt it's important for them to sacrifice for their children and their grandchildren even at this stage in their life. And this is very much tied to an intergenerational contract in Chinese families. So this respondent in Singapore said, "It's my responsibility since my child needs my help. It's about sacrificing. When we were young, we sacrificed for our parents, and now that we are older, we sacrifice for our son and grandson." So it's a very, you know, sense of moral responsibility there. So one of the things that kind of made sense to us through this project was the intersection between political economy, moral economy, and familyhood. This other respondent from Sydney said, "When you migrate, your spirits are lifted when you take care of your child and your child's children. Okay, my sacrifice is what I ought to do. What rewards do I have? There's no need for me to be so calculative because they treat me well." So there's a different kind of satisfaction that they obtain. In the process of doing our research, one of the papers we are in the process of writing has to do with the argument that Well, we used to think that filial piety ties are a very central pillar of Chinese families. So by filial piety, it's when the child expresses gratitude and repays the debt to their parents. But with these one-child family and migrant families that we studied abroad, we're arguing that the intergenerational contract is actually shifting from one of reciprocity, okay, to one that is more child-focused. So we see these grandparents moving, you know, abroad, taking on additional grandparenting duties akin to a second work life, and in some cases, even supporting their children financially in the foreign country. As I mentioned, what are the everyday relations and activities that these grandparents do to give and to receive care? It ranges from marketing to preparing meals, fetching the grandchildren to and from school for social activities, and being involved in family life by educating and nurturing them. So it's got to do with the practical daily activities as well as the moral transfer of values and nurturing activities. Now, you may ask, in the case of Singapore, there is an option to hire foreign domestic workers. So why don't these Chinese migrant families do it? Okay, so we found that the Chinese migrant families were more reluctant to hire domestic workers because they perceived the domestic worker as a stranger that would be living with the family. So in this case, the grandmother says, if we hired a maid, okay, then there will be two kids. One is the baby and the second one is a domestic helper. So they would end up having to watch over, be watchful towards the domestic helper. And they say in the end, help from the grandparents is still needed. So that's why, and I think this is one reason. The other reason is some of the families did find it expensive to hire a domestic worker, whereas if you call on your parent, okay, the grandparent to come, you won't have to pay the salary. Okay, now that was about how they give care, okay, they support care activities. But in our study, in accordance with the care circulations framework, we also wanted to pay attention to how the grandparents receive care. And so, for instance, we would ask, you know, do you think you have sacrificed or gained more through this migration process? So this respondent says there are definitely more gains. Though we have sacrificed, there's a lot of joy in taking care of our grandson. We would miss him dearly if we don't see him. Another respondent based in Singapore said that her daughter actually brings her overseas to overseas trips in the Southeast Asian region. And if, let's say, she and her husband remain back in China, they would not get to enjoy such luxuries because of the small value of the renminbi. So they feel very contented because apart from receiving family warmth, they are also able to enjoy certain activities that they would not have if they had remained in China. So I think drawing these the earlier slides together, what we have observed in accordance with this seminar series, right, trying to think about how our work speaks to this seminar series, what we notice is it's very evident that there is a transfer of surplus value across borders. And this surplus value is actually transferred across generations as well. So the individual biographies of the grandparents are very much intertwined with structural practices in the workplace, by nation states, as well as the kind of social institutions or ideologies that the grandparents and migrant families are embedded in. And so we think that the idea of the global intimate, a term introduced by geographers Alison Mounts and Jennifer Hyman, okay, nicely captures, okay, how these global flows can actually, they are shaped and they do shape structural practices and social relations in national contexts. And in addition to that, there's a very intimate aspect to how grandparenting migration actually shapes family life. Not just for their adult children, but across generations for their grandchildren as well. So as I've mentioned, this type of elderly migration enables the adult children to participate in the paid labor force. And at the same time, it's about nurturing their grandchildren to become ideal citizens in the future for the immigration country, okay, through education, through the teaching of moral values. So, for instance, this respondent and his wife, R2 and R3, they're a couple in Sydney, and they mentioned to us their relationship, the care relations they have with their daughter. So they said, it is difficult for my daughter to juggle work and parental duties. We started coming when my daughter was 2 months old. I told my daughter that she needs to work in order to avoid losing touch with society. And they had, when the daughter was younger, the parents had taken care of her education fees, sent her abroad to study. And even when she was an adult living in Australia, they were very worried that she would not have a place of her own. She was renting initially, and the parents eventually helped her to buy her property. Okay, and then the second bullet point is on their care relations with their grandchild. So his mother, the grandson's mother, has tasked us with monitoring him, making sure that he does his homework. Okay, there's a typo there. But he doesn't listen to us, he doesn't like to study, he only wants to play. So the grandparents, you know, have a custodian role to carry out as well while they are doing their grandparenting duties. So again, these types of social reproductive activities, okay, they're held together through mutual consent, right? What the grandparents buy into in terms of thinking we should sacrifice for our children and our grandchildren. And it's taken almost as common sense. It's reproduced in an unquestioning way to provide a compass in terms of this migration decisions and how the grandparents should participate in the functioning of family life for their migrant children. But at the same time, these types of common sense ideologies and activities, they also have an impact on how the grandparents think about their future aging back in China. And I'll talk about that briefly. But I think the last point here, I wanted to highlight that the social reproductive activities they carry out contributes to capitalist production and reproduction in multiple ways. Okay, so I mentioned labor power and nurturing the next generation, but the grandparents also help, especially in the case of Sydney, help their children to purchase real estate. Okay, so what has happened then is with the PRC migrant families going to places like Sydney, buying real estate, it has actually inflated housing prices for the domestic population, leading to affordability concerns for citizens in Sydney and Singapore. In Singapore, it is easier to manage, okay, the workings of the capitalist economy because the state is very interventionist. So 80% of the household live in public housing. And in order to qualify to buy public housing, you have to be a permanent resident or a citizen. And even if you are a permanent resident, you need to wait for 3 years before you can actually purchase a public housing flat. So through these kinds of controls, right, in housing policy, the Singapore state has managed to prevent a spike in housing property prices, or at least to try and manage it. But in Sydney, it's basically the real estate speculation by PRC migrants and developers have basically driven housing prices much higher than they were in the past. So in both countries, there are tightening immigration and property restrictions in Sydney and Singapore. Okay, so from here onwards, I actually want to think about, ask you to think about, you know, how do the grandparents envision their aging later in the life course? So here we start off with a question that in a national context, the state sets the parameters in which social reproduction happens. Okay, the state may support or offload the cost of reproduction onto the family. So within a national context, social reproduction activities are very much, in a sense, sort of entwined with the role of the state. But when we think about elder care in a transnational context where older people are moving across borders, which national society should then be responsible for elder care? Okay, so immigration countries, they benefit from aged reproductive labor, right? So they benefit from having grandparents do childcare duties at no cost in order to enable adult children to work, okay? But because these grandparents are not able to remain in the long term in immigration countries, when they are older, they then become the responsibility of the migrant sending country. So it's the migrant sending country which will have to become responsible for elder care. And actually, our grandparenting migrants very much are bought into kind of the belief that they will, or rather, okay, so they realize that it's hard for them to remain in Singapore and Sydney. And so perhaps out of resignation or choice, they actually indicate that they see themselves aging more likely in China. And actually, in China, they said there's better medical insurance for them, so there's less of a financial burden. That's the practical part of it. In Singapore, as well as Sydney, the medical bills are significant. So when these grandparents go to Sydney, they are required to buy private insurance. Okay, but in the case of Singapore, there's no such sort of regulation for them. So most of the grandparents we interviewed in Singapore did not have any form of insurance. So if they fell ill, needed to be hospitalized, they would be fully responsible for hospital bills. So this particular respondent from Singapore says, returning to China is a long-term plan in about 10 years because becoming a PR or citizen is not easy. And also they felt that if they were to become to age in Singapore or Sydney, then the cost of elder care will have to be borne by themselves and their children rather than the government's. So production and reproduction activities are practices that in our reading, they are mutually constitutive. They contribute to production, but yet they also exist in tension. Okay, and geographer Jim Glassman has said that the geographic transfer of surplus will allow workers in one location to reduce their levels of exploitation, right? So in the case of Sydney and Singapore, being able to call on the reproductive labor of the grandparents actually make things easier for the domestic population. But it would be at the expense of our future aging needs in China at the other end. So China, as you all know, has a rapidly aging population, and according to a Bloomberg report, okay, its biggest fiscal risk is actually to do with pensions. Okay, so actually when the cost of elder care is outsourced, okay, to China, China's assembly country is basically the government will have to be prepared, okay, for the aging needs of older people whose migrant children will not be with them. Okay. Now, I think at the same time, we don't want to just provide a kind of a simplistic portrayal by saying that you know, the grandparents are disadvantaged because they cannot immigrate to their families, and they will then have to, they and the Chinese government will have to bear the cost and responsibility of aging. Because I think much of the literature on grandparenting migration now assumes that these aged migrants want to seek family reunification abroad. And this is a very typical kind of depiction in immigration research, that migrants, you know, are a potential burden and they all want to go to the immigration country. And actually in our research we found that that is not necessarily the case, because the elderly have their own subjectivities and desires, okay, when it comes to their plans to age. So, and of course, you know, what follows here is very much tied to considerations, both over choice as well as constraints. So it's not straightforward. But what we want to highlight here is that the elderly also should be studied with an attentiveness to what are their subjectivities like. And we found that many of them actually said that living abroad with their children is very restrictive, because they're adult children have grown up independently of them for 10, 15, 20 years, right? And then suddenly they have to all live together in Singapore in a maybe three-bedroom flat. So it becomes too close for comfort. They actually cherish the autonomy away from their grandparenting duties abroad. So when I'm in China, you know, I'm independent, I don't have to worry about when to pick up the kids, grandkids, when to do cooking. There's an independence that comes from living in their own homes. Okay, they also value the social welfare benefits that are available to them as Chinese citizens. They felt that we've contributed in the past, and now, you know, we should, in a sense, stand to benefit from those social rights. Also, their salaries and their savings, they felt more free to spend in Chinese renminbi, rather than feeling very penny conscious about how the currency rate translates, okay, when they're paying in Singapore, Australian dollars. What we did find was, even as they articulated these considerations, okay, and we asked them about, you know, what are your expectations of care later in life, we found that they had adapted their attitudes. They realized that their migrant children were very unlikely to move back to China. So they minimized expectation of receiving embodied care, okay, which we refer to, think of as proximate, hands-on care, okay, from their children. and instead they are open towards and they anticipate expressions of disembodied care. So meaning this is care that takes place through emotional support, through symbolic gestures, you know, or virtual interactions, for example through WeChat. So WeChat is a very important social app for these grandparents. It not only enables them to have video calls, send text messages, but for example, their children can send them during the Chinese New Year or during their birthdays, Chinese red packets with electronic currency. So it's another way for their children to express care through these types of virtual technologies. So I'm going to end with, I think, 4 points. So how do these grandparents actually practically envision their care later in life? So there are some who do desire to have family reunification, and so they hope that they can apply for permanent residency and stay with their adult children in Australia or Singapore. So this particular lady, she's widowed, and she says she's currently in the queue, but this is that 10-20-year queue, and they don't intend to pay extra, you know, processing fee, the $40,000 amount. She says, but you don't know when it will be your turn because it's a long queue. And some friends have asked, have told her to ask her daughter to write to the authorities to expedite the application, especially since her husband is no longer around. But the daughter feels that there's no point doing it. So basically, there's a sense of helplessness. The second option is they see themselves returning to China to spend their silver years, and they have a few kind of permutations that they are playing with. So the best situation they felt would be to age in their own homes and to hire a, they call it a baomu, which basically it's translated very roughly as a nanny, but it's basically a domestic worker, usually from a rural part of China, who will help with the household chores and the sort of more physically tiring aspects of daily life. And they say, we hope our children will come back often to visit us. Another option, which a few of our respondents have taken up, is that they are considering going to a retirement home. And at least two or three of them have already bought those homes in preparation, okay, for older age. And they say the retirement homes in China these days, you know, the quality and the facilities are good. You don't have to worry about your food, your laundry. Another respondent, the second bullet point, told us that they bought a retirement home for about 600,000 renminbi. I'm not sure what that translates to in terms of pounds, but in Singapore dollars, that's probably about 100,000 Singapore dollars. So probably about 80,000 pounds or thereabouts. I don't know, maybe Yao can confirm for me later. So in other words, maybe from an international context, it's not that expensive, but in China, I think that's a princely sum. So this person says, you know, these retirement homes, there's a lake nearby, it's near the mountains, and the environment is amazing. The fourth option is to continue to be transnational, which means that they expect that they, and they hope that they can live in both countries, moving, you know, between China and Australia in this case. Clearly, this is a respondent who is well-to-do and says, I have the conditions to do so, that's the point. So this person has 3 properties in Sydney and 2 in China. And she's not the only one in our sample set. Okay, so to conclude, I think in this presentation, what I wanted to highlight that is as we studied grandparenting migration, we started off with an interest in social reproduction. We wanted to see what is the role these grandparents play in order to support their adult children's productive activities, and how they are in fact also nurturing future citizens for the immigration countries. So in developing this project, you know, we found that there's an important intersection of political and moral economy, and this is very much manifested and shaped by the family unit. So there's an intersection of labor power, childcare, elder care, and state-led regulations over immigration and welfare rights. So there are many different balls that we are juggling as we try to analyze our results, and hopefully, you know, it has come across in a coherent way to you. But the overarching question for us really is, how do we think about care ethics in a transnational world? So in this particular case, we talked about how the elder care responsibility for these grandparents are subsequently outsourced to the migrant country. But in another component, we were also interested to see how Myanmar domestic workers who go to Singapore to take care of the elderly, they have left behind their elderly parents. So who looks after their elderly parents? So the overall trace project is about transnational relations, aging and care ethics. So I think to end off with, for the purpose of this presentation, I've highlighted that the grandparenting migrants carry out childcare, and in fact, the immigration countries are extracting surplus value from their unpaid labour. But then these same immigration countries restrict family reunification rights, and the grandparents will have to return to their sending country in the future. So this raises questions about who will bear future elder care costs, as well as what kind of a social support ecosystem will be needed for grandparents like that when their migrant children are not with them to provide proximate care. I think so ending off, and this is probably an aspect that we are still trying to read up more on, it has to do with frameworks of transnational social protection. So Peggy Levitt, Thomas Feist, they have written, I think published in a special issue on this, and haven't dug deep enough into it. But the question that then comes up is, as grandparents move across borders and their elder care is distributed in different countries across the life course, what kind of social protection framework would be most suitable for transnationals like that? So practically speaking, some countries do have bilateral agreements. So Canada, for example, has a bilateral agreement with Germany and I think Spain to do with pension portability. Okay, and I think one of the things which I feel is important to think about is how do we develop portable systems of care to do with healthcare and elder care as well, when we consider care needs across borders, across the life course, and across generations. Another possible framework may have to do with insurance schemes. Okay, so can the market take on a more hands-on role in terms of coming up with insurance schemes where it is possible for people to tap into insurance plans in different countries across the life course, even when they are paying primarily to the insurance scheme of in a particular country. So these are, I think, things we're still playing around with, and at the moment I don't think I have a very clear answer, but if you know of any references or you have examples to share, please do so during the Q&A. Okay, so that's all. Thank you very much.